Well, before we begin, I just want to say that while we've been practicing together here, I've been noticing lots of familiar faces from, I guess, my previous visits to Sims. I don't know how many times I've been here, two or three or more times. And so it's great to see you all again, those of you who I've practiced with before. And so I feel really at home among friends. That's great. Makes a lot easier. Kind of scary to talk to a bunch of people that you don't really know, you know. But when you're among friends, you can just relax. So that's good. Okay, so creativity. Lately I've been thinking that our practice mostly has to do with investigating the obvious. You know, because we take things for granted, and who knows what we mean by all these things that we take for granted, and maybe the fact that we don't know what we mean and we don't know what we're talking about most of the time has a bad effect on us somehow. So maybe the whole point of spiritual practice is to kind of, you know, really see, what do I actually mean when I say myself or think of myself? What's actually going on when I talk about my life? What is friendship? You know, what is love? What is death? Things like that, that we think we know what we're talking about. It may be we really are not sure. We take things for granted. So similarly, in the case of creativity, pretty much people like creativity. Maybe somebody might think, well, creativity is not so good. It might get unruly or be out of bounds, but mostly people don't think that. Probably you all think creativity is a good thing, not a bad thing, right? Don't you think that most people think that? But do we know what creativity actually is, or even what we mean? Never mind what it actually is. What do we mean when we say creativity, and when we think about creativity? Do we actually know? So I think that's a good place to start, is to find out. In the beginning, what we think we mean by creativity. So I think we should start with a brief investigation of this question for ourselves. And I think we can do that by everybody turning to someone next to them and having a conversation that lasts for 6 or 7 minutes. And the conversation is, here's what I mean by creativity. What do you mean? I mean, think about it. You know, what do you mean by it? Why are you interested in creativity? Why do you think it's a good thing? What does it mean? What's the difference between creativity and there's no creativity? How do you feel when you're creative? Do you identify creativity by a certain feeling that you have? What is that feeling? How do you feel when you feel like there's zero creativity? And why don't you like that feeling if it's true that you don't like it? I mean, what about creativity, actually? What do you think about it? And what can you learn from the wise person sitting next to you who might have a different view of creativity? So before we start talking about creativity and I say anything about it, I mean, it would be good to know what we think about it to begin with, right? So let's do that. Let's everybody turn to the person next to you, and hopefully everybody has at least one person to talk to. And there's only two possibilities, that there's an even number of people in the room or there's an odd number of people in the room. If there's an odd number of people in the room and there's one person left over, they can talk to me. Okay? And if not, everybody has a partner. So everybody okay? Everybody have someone to talk to? Somebody left out? One person left out? Okay, come. Okay, there you go. You found each other. Okay, I'll ring the bell after 5 or 7 minutes and talk about this.
So in my little tour around the room, I heard little phrases like creative juices flowing. It didn't come from me. Somebody mentioned meditation. I heard somebody say spontaneity. I can't remember what else, but
lots of different phrases. And then I stuck my ear on one of the speakers, and I heard no discernible words at all, but just kind of a roar, which made sense also. So what did you say? What did you hear? Just some phrases, some quick thoughts about creativity. Yeah.
My partner came over from my life with a gift for staying with it.
A gift for staying with it. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
My partner and I decided that creativity is freedom.
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 Freedom. Yeah. Yeah. What else?
Freedom and mystery.
Freedom and mystery. Yeah. What else? Yes.
Both my partner and I are in the process of recreating our lives. We're both just kind of a fork in the road.
Uh-huh.
It's really interesting to talk about the recreation of our lives.
Recreation, yeah. Yeah. Recreation is the same, yeah. Recreation is and recreation are the same word, right? Yeah. Yeah, other... Yes. Stuckness, numbness is the opposite of creativity. Yeah.
So to feel creative keeps us alive. It could be just putting a day together with people that you care about.
Yes, yes, right. Creativity as aliveness. Even just ordinary things could be quite creative, yeah.
Caring about.
Yeah, yeah, caring. Yes. I'm repeating these things for the tape and so everybody can hear. Yes. Adaptability, acceptance,
flexibility,
and acceptance. Yeah, our foundations of creativity. Yeah, yeah.
Trust.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I think. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Letting go of fear.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I guess. Related, it is very much, that is trust, right? Letting go of fear and trusting, yeah.
The creativity releases a great deal of energy.
Release of energy, yeah. That's right. You could be exhausted and tired. All of a sudden, if you become creative, you find you have energy you didn't know you had, yeah. That's true. Mm-hmm, yeah. Oh, whoops. Go ahead, yeah. There are three people in a diagonal. One in the back, one in the middle, and one in the front. So let's start in the back, yeah. Yeah, a vessel for something greater than yourself, yeah. Yes?
We explored questions of whether there's space for training in creativity.
Uh-huh, that's interesting, yeah.
Training,
is there, could there be training, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Along with the idea of being a vessel, sort of catching what comes through.
Catching what comes through, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. It springs up. That goes along with the spontaneity. It springs up. It springs up of itself. Yeah. Yeah, in the way in the back, yeah.
Motion.
Uh-huh. It's moving. It's always moving, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Play.
Yeah. Say again.
Play.
Play. Yeah, play. Freedom. Play. Yeah.
Coming from within dreams,
yeah. One or two more. Yeah.
Expressiveness, or being self-expression.
Self-expression, yeah. Okay, this is great. You know, all of these things, there's a lot of different things. I don't think in any of these comments there have been too much repeated. It's all been different angles on creativity. Well, I wanted to read you, I found this week I was looking at Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. You know this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind? I think most people who practice Buddhism know about this book. It's a very old book. It's 35, 40 years old by now, but you can still read it, and it's still wonderful. So I've read it numerous times, and I keep going back to it. And I found this in it this week about creativity, where Suzuki Roshi talks about creativity. And so I thought I would share this couple of page passage with you And so that we can think about, see what he says, and think about what he's talking about, and see how it relates to these things that we've been discovering. It's rather surprising, actually, what he says about creativity, especially the title of the, you know, how Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is divided up into little titled sections, even though Suzuki Roshi himself didn't give them these titles. They're titled. And the title of this little section is God-Giving, which is very surprising, isn't it, for a Buddhist to talk about God-Giving. Anyway, I'm not going to read the whole of this part, but just a section of it. He says, according to Christianity, every existence in nature is something which was created for or given to us by God. This is the perfect idea of giving, that it's given by God. I guess on the theory that God doesn't have any ulterior motives, isn't looking for any advantage. So it's pure giving. But if you think that God created you, and that therefore you are somehow separate from God, you are liable to think you have the ability to create something separate, something not given by God. For instance, we create airplanes and highways, and when we repeat, I create, I create, I create, I create, I create, soon we forget who is actually the I, capital I, and he has it in quotation marks, who is actually the I which creates the various things. We forget who is the I which creates the various things, and we soon forget about God. So this goes to a lot of the comments about it. You know, it just comes like an artesian well. It's not me who's doing it. Creativity seems to feel like I don't take credit for this. This is not me. And I think the fear, the absence of fear that we talked about as being creativity, that has to do with that. If I'm in charge of being creative right now, this puts a lot of pressure on me. And now I'm nervous. And I can't be very creative. But if I trust, what am I saying? I'm saying it's not about me. I'm trusting somehow I can access a bigger space, right? I think that's what he's saying. This point should not be forgotten. But because we do forget who is doing the creating and the reason for the creation, we become attached to the material or exchange value, which has no value in comparison to the absolute value of something as God's creation. So in other words, if we focus on something as God's creation, it has absolute value, and therefore the fact that one person's creation wins the prize and the other person's creation is obscure doesn't really matter. That's not really important, but we do become very focused on the relative value of something, right? And we get intimidated. Well, since I didn't win a prize, and I don't think I can win a prize, I better not be creative. I'll leave that to the people who do win the prizes, right? Don't you think that we think that? We become intimidated. And we feel that we don't have the right to be creative. But here he's saying, no, there's an absolute value in creativity when we understand it's not our production. Even though something has no material value or any relative value to any small I, in quotes with a capital letter I, it has absolute value in itself. Not to be attached to something is to be aware of its absolute value. Not to be attached to something is to be aware of its absolute value. And this is one of the great things about Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, is you could stop at any sentence and think about it for around a year. It's very pithy that way, you know? So that's true. I mean, this is a little bit of an astonishing statement. What is it, you know, to think about? Not to be attached to something is to be aware of its absolute value. And you would think the opposite. If I'm not attached to it, it means I don't value it anymore. If I value it, I'm attached to it. But he's saying that the meaning of non-attachment is to recognize the absolute value of something. If you recognize the absolute value of your loved one, let's say, not the relative value of your loved one, she's valuable to me, he's valuable to me because he gives me what I need, and so on and so forth, and I'm attached. But if I recognize the absolute value of my loved one, it's just non-attachment. Fascinating thing to consider. Anyway, everything you do should be based on such awareness and not on material or self-centered ideas of value. Then whatever you do is true giving. Now here it gets really, to me, rather extraordinary and surprising. You know, he says, when we sit in the cross-legged posture in meditation, we resume our fundamental activity of creation. Now, who would have thought that? When we return to meditation, we resume, as if it was there before, all along, but we had forgotten about it, and now we resume the fundamental activity of creation. There are perhaps three kinds of creation. Three kinds of creation. The first is to be aware of ourselves after we finish meditating. Now, who would think such a thing? You know, Suzuki Roshi thinks things like this. That's the first kind of creativity. After we finish meditation and we stand up and we become aware of ourselves and we return to our lives, that's a creative act. When we sit, we are nothing. And I have to just make a footnote here to say that in Zen practice, we don't understand what we call zazen, is the Zen word, as you probably all know, for sitting meditation. We don't think of it as meditation, that we're meditating on something, or we're meditating to purify the mind, or meditating for some reason. We think of it, as he's saying here, sitting down and resuming our original absolute value, or resuming our creativity. It's not actually meditation in the Zen way of looking at it. It's just sitting, right? Sitting, returning to silence, returning to zero, returning to our absolute value. So he says, when we sit, we are nothing. We don't even realize what we are. We just sit. But when we stand up, there we are again. Creativity. It's a creative act. Whoops, there we are. The whole world comes to exist all over again. And this is the first step in creation. When you are there, everything else is there. Everything is created all at once. So this is what I mean by, you know, investigating the obvious. You know, who would have thought of this as, you know, the ultimate source creative act, just to be there, coming from nothing. When we emerge from nothing, when everything emerges from nothing, we see it all as a fresh new creation. This is non-attachment. So that's the first kind of creation. Just sort of resuming, I guess, just recognizing that we're alive and that we're here is a creative act. And it's associated with meditation practice. Putting down, in a way, when you're sitting in meditation, you might not think about it this way, but actually it's true. When you're sitting in meditation, you're sort of suspending your life. You're saying, I'm not doing anything now. I'm not going to make anything, create anything, fix anything, do anything. I'm just going to be here with whatever arises. And then you get up from meditation and life begins again. And that's basic creativity. The second kind of creativity is when you act or produce or prepare something like food or tea, like you were saying. Just doing something to benefit others or to get through the day or take care of things. That's the second kind of creation. The third kind is to create something within yourself, such as education or culture or art or some system for our society. So there are three kinds of creation. And I think that we privilege pretty much the third kind. In other words, we think that creativity is to write a poem, you know, make some art, make something beautiful. We think that that's creativity. Most of us, I don't think, even think of preparing some food or taking care of a space we live in as creativity. Although you said that, you guys were talking about that. But he's saying that is a form of creativity. Imagine if we thought of it that way. If we thought of taking care of the ordinary things in our lives as creativity. They could be done in a creative spirit or not, of course. But suppose we saw them as potentially creative. So the second kind, and then the first kind, the primary kind, as he says, is returning to the feeling of just being alive and appreciating that we're here, arising out of nothingness. So there are three kinds of creation, but if you forget the first, the most important one, the most fundamental one, the other two will be like children who have lost their parents. And their creation will mean nothing. So he's saying there could be, think about this, there could be a lot of seemingly creative stuff going on in life. You could be seemingly creating wonderful paintings and poems and making a beautiful environment and so on and so forth. But if it's not connected to the first kind of creativity, it's like a child who's lost its parents. It's a little bit running around with homeless, you know, without groundedness, without, you know, really being, rooted in true creativity, he's saying. Usually we all forget about Zazen. We forget about God. We work very hard at the second and third kinds of creation, but God does not help in the activity. Then he says, how is it possible for God to help when God does not realize who he is? Implying that when we sit in meditation, this is what we're doing. We're helping God to realize who God is, or Buddha to realize who Buddha is, or, you know, fundamental truth to be activated. And I think this is, you know, the great secret of our religious life, is that we have something to do here. It's not done to us, you know, we have something to do here. It's up to us to respond to the Absolute through our spiritual practice, through our religious life. And when we do that, when we take our part, then the creativity that comes from a bigger space than our personalities will respond to our activity. Seems to be what he means, I think. And because we forget about this, we have so many problems in this world. When we forget the fundamental source of our creativity, we are like children who do not know what to do when they lose their parents. And when you think about the world that we live in today, it does kind of feel like that there's been a lot of creativity going on in our world, perpetrated by people who are like children running around without their parents. I get that feeling when I look at some of the things that the government does. This is something that, like, a 16-year-old boy might do who was far away from home and didn't have any reference to kind of parental supervision. Very creative and wonderful things, but a little misguided and ungrounded, you know? Do you get that feeling? Yeah. So he says, of course, and again, so wonderful, Suki Roshi, so he says, of course, to live is to create problems. Of course, as we all know, to be alive is automatically to create problems. So this is very reassuring, you know. If we did not appear in the world, our parents would not have so much trouble with us. Just by appearing, we have created problems for them. And he's talking to younger people. It's probably most of his audience at this time was, you know, young people who were living in reference to their parents, trying to overcome their parents. Maybe a lot of us are a little older, so we might put it on the other foot. You know, our children have given us a big problem just by being there. If they weren't there, we wouldn't have the problems that we have. Some are more aware of this than others. So this is okay, he says, because everybody creates some problems. But usually people think that when they die, everything is over, the problems disappear. But your death may also cause a lot of problems. Actually, our problems should be dissolved in this lifetime. If we are aware that what we do or what we create is really the gift of the big I, then we will not be attached to it and we will not create problems for ourselves or for others. So, this is Suzuki Roshi's sort of wonderfully rambling discussion of creativity, which I think, you know, is very deep. And it goes to a lot of the comments that we were making. The feeling that we have that you know, we might be afraid if we're, I, you, any one of us, if it depends on our talent and our skill, maybe it's a little fearful, so we have to overcome that fear and trust something bigger than ourselves, as we said. And it, the creativity flows through us, not as our possession. It's as if there's a flow of creativity that creates energy, right? That seems to be somehow already there. But we may become estranged from it and lose track of it, and we have to find our way back to it. And then somebody said, is there a training involved here? Is there a way that we find our way back to it? And maybe one answer to that, following Suzuki Roshi, is meditation practice. And maybe viewing meditation practice as a pathway to creativity might give us a different angle on our meditation practice. But then also it seems that that to get from the first primary form of creativity to the other forms of creativity then take some application of our human knowledge and skill. So maybe it's a combination of applying ourselves to the primary form of creativity to keep ourselves open to something bigger than ourselves, as he puts it in this little talk, to God, or however we want to call it. A lot of people find the word God troublesome, so whatever word we use, something bigger than ourselves. And then what? So I thought for fun, next thing I want to do is tell you a little story and read you a passage from my book, Sailing Home. Some of you might have been, I was at Elliott Bay in the summertime when the book came out. And it's a fun book, and I want to, and this is a passage I want to read, which leads to a little exercise and reflection that we can do together. So I need to, before I read the passage, I need to a little bit set the context. Some of you know the book? Yeah, some of you do. Oh, and I forgot, I want to ask before I go into this, because it's going to lead into a writing exercise. Who does not have the wherewithal to do some writing? You don't have a pencil, you don't have any paper. Who doesn't have that? Raise your hand if you don't. One person who doesn't? Only one. One other there. So I know Joe has a few extra pens. So we'll have those of you who have extra things to put a few sheets of paper and a few pens up here on the stage, and then those of you who need it can come up and get it, okay, so that we can just automatically do that when the time comes so nobody's left out. Okay. So, just to set the context for this little story. So this Sailing Home, the subtitle of the book is Using the Wisdom of Homer's Odyssey to Navigate Life's Perils and Pitfalls. And it's actually a reading of the Odyssey, as if the Odyssey were a text describing the process of spiritual practice. And of course, we're all the time reading texts as if they describe the process of spiritual practice, but usually the texts we're reading are things like the Sutras of the Buddha or the Bible or something like that, texts that were explicitly designed to be about the spiritual process. And I found over a long period of time of talking to people and studying these kinds of texts that one characteristic of them is that they are, of their nature, extremely idealistic. Because the Buddha was not your average person, right? So if you're following the deeds and sayings of the Buddha, you're following the deeds and sayings of an extraordinary person, and you're trying to emulate them. And of course, we're all extraordinary people too, but maybe not in the same way that the Buddha was extraordinary. So sometimes, this is, I think, one of the flip sides of religious practice, is that we can all go around thinking that we're failing at it, right? Because we're not quite coming up to the standards of the Buddha or Jesus or somebody like that. So what if we read the Odyssey, whose main character is a deceiving, double-dealing person who often screws up, falls asleep when he should be awake, gives into his desire when he should forbear, you know, turns left when he should be turning right, and gets in all kinds of trouble because of this. This begins to sound more like us in some ways, you know. So what if we read that text? It would really yield a kind of different information about the spiritual path, wouldn't it? It would really tell us what actually happens. This, to me, like, there's a great difference between, here's what's supposed to happen. And we read that, yes, yes, we really think that's supposed to happen, yes, we do. And here's what actually happens. That's a different story. So, in reading the Odyssey, I could talk about, you know, and I've been, you know, doing this path. And in Zen, you know, we really, part of our tradition really features a close relationship between teachers and students, so that practicing Zen with people over such a long time, I've really gotten to know very intimately what happens in people's lives. And usually practice doesn't go smooth, you know, A, B, C, D, enlightenment. It doesn't usually go that way. It usually goes A, Z, D, A. So the Odyssey really worked for reflecting what really happens in spiritual process. So anyway, that's the background. So I actually go through and read the Odyssey and all the different. I don't comment obviously on every word of the Odyssey, but I select different famous episodes. And one of the most famous, and a lot of the episodes, have to do with disastrous occurrences, which are always happening to Odysseus for various reasons. And one can't help but notice, you live long enough and you notice that disaster seems to be an indelible feature of the spiritual path. It seems to be, you know, a regularly occurring phenomenon. And which is one reason why a spiritual path can often be a little disappointing, because you're thinking, oh, if I follow the spiritual path, this is guaranteed to save me any disasters. But then you discover, whoops, disasters do happen. And what do we do about it? Anyway, this is one of Odysseus's most famous disasters. So the plot of the story is that after having gone out and fought in the Trojan Wars for 10 years, Odysseus, now older and wiser, is trying to come home to Ithaca, his native place, Penelope, his wife. And all he's trying to do is come home, but it turns out that it's not so easy. And he keeps getting blown off course, and, you know, it's quite an odyssey, actually, getting home. So, at one point, they're out of provisions, and they need to land somewhere on an island to reprovision their ships so that they can continue on their journey home. By the way, the journey home takes 10 years. Before it's over, before he lands on Ithaca, and then his problems are just beginning. But this is happens along the way home. They land on this island to get provisions, and it happens to be the island of the Cyclops. This island is inhabited by Cyclops. So, now, as we, earlier in the story, we learned that Odysseus, as I said before, is very wily and sneaky and deceptive. And these are the characteristics in ancient Greek culture that amount to civilization. Mm-hmm. To be civilized, we have to develop and be crafty, and, you know, there's a way. We're not just rough and just do what comes naturally. civilization is exactly the channeling of our roughness into ways, which is a kind of deception, right? Kind of like, well, I really feel like this, but I'm going to look like this, right? So Odysseus is very deceptive, very wily, very tricky. That's his main characteristic. And the Greek island of Ithaca and other Greek islands are very civilized. They have customs. They meet in council. They have forms of government. They have rules of hospitality and so on and so forth. So they land on the island of the Cyclops. Now, the thing about the Cyclops is that they are not crafty and wily. They are exactly rough, and they live without refinement. They don't build houses, which is, you know, takes a while, the craft of building homes. They don't build houses. They live in caves. They don't farm, which takes craft and skill. They subsist on milk and meat provided by their livestock. They don't know how to farm. They live apart from one another, and they never meet in council. They don't have villages. They just have this one's cave here and that one's cave over there. Each one a law unto himself and his own family. They don't know how to make ships, like all the other Greeks. So they can't go out to other islands and learn about how other people live and see other points of view and compare. They can't do that. They don't know how to build ships. They are one-eyed. Cyclops are one-eyed. They have no depth perception. They don't see others. They only see themselves. And they're isolated from the rest of the world and from any form of civilization, and they just occupy themselves with the rudimentary business of eating, sleeping, and herding. No culture, no skills, no wiles. But being alone and unrefined and self-sufficient gives them one big advantage. Literally, a big advantage. The Cyclops are huge. They're giants. They're like huge, like 20, 30 feet in size, gigantic creatures. So, Odysseus and his men land on the Cyclops Island, and there's nobody around. They kind of crash around. They notice a cave that looked like it might be inhabited. They go into the cave. They see all this wonderful cheese and milk and meat and stuff like that, and they eat to their, because they're pretty hungry, they eat to their fill, they fill up their provision bags, they're ready to go back to the ship. But now Odysseus has one of his many serious lapses of judgment. Because all the men are saying, okay, good, we got what we need, let's leave well enough alone, let's go back to the ship. And Odysseus says, wait a minute, let's not go so fast. After all, whenever you land on an island of civilized people, he doesn't, of course, realize that they haven't landed on an island of civilized people. But whenever you land on an island of civilized people, they take you in, you get to talk to them and find out something about them, and they always give you a guest gift. So why should we rush away so quickly? Why don't we wait around and see what kind of a gift we'll get from these seemingly strange people? We don't know what they're like, and we can find out what they're like, and we can... So Odysseus's, you know, cleverness and wiliness and sort of interest and curiosity are getting the best of him. So they actually decide, or he decides, against the protests of everybody else, that they're going to stay there and wait for their hosts to come back so they can meet them, greet them, and receive a guest gift. So there they are, waiting in the cave, and in comes the Cyclops, and to their great shock, he's about 30 feet tall, gigantic creature. And he walks in the door of the cave, and he then closes, and the herds come in, and he closes the door of the cave with a gigantic boulder, which the text tells us would take 20 or 30, is that right? Yeah, 22, no, 22. It's an exact number. 22 chariots it would take to move this boulder. That's how big this boulder is. And now the men are locked inside the cave. So Polyphemus, which is his name, comes and here finds these little Greeks about this big, you know, running around his cave, and he thinks this is pretty funny. And he says, "Who are you?" And Odysseus, one of his characteristics, and I think this is our characteristics as well, we're very much like Odysseus in this, when someone asks us who we are, we never tell the truth. Right? We never tell the truth. We have a story. So he's always got a story. Who are you? And he makes up some story that's not at all true. And the Cyclops, and he says, and we need your help, and we're here, you know, our ships are destroyed. Not true, the ships are just on the beach. Our ships are destroyed, and we really need your help, and that's why we're here. Please help us, and we're here, you know, throwing ourselves on your mercy. And the Cyclops ignores all this. And in a very gory scene, and I don't mean to upset you, but it's a very gory scene, he grabs a bunch of the Greeks, he smashes their heads against the cave wall, and eats them all together. Yeah, hair, bones, the whole business, and he washes it down with a big pail of goat's milk. And of course, Odysseus in his manner is looking on with horror at this scene. So the Cyclops, you know, settled down for the evening, figuring, you know, what does he have to fear from these little guys? But Odysseus, you know, is really riled up by this and really upset, and he decides he's going to get revenge, so he's sharpening up his sword, and he's ready to, when the Cyclops goes to sleep, run the Cyclops through and seek revenge for these killings. But then he realizes that, we'll be trapped in here forever if we kill the Cyclops. We can't do that. What are we going to do? We need another plan. And he's good at thinking up plans, but nothing comes to mind right away. And the next day comes, the Cyclops wakes up, and there they are all in there. He has a few more Greeks for breakfast. Odysseus is realizing this is a desperate affair. I mean, how long can this go on? And so he hatches another plan, which involves taking one of the staffs that's in the cave and making a big long stake, sharpening it at the end, and curing it in the fire. So that evening when the Cyclops returns from his herding, Odysseus offers him a special wine that was given to him when he set out on his journey 10 years before. Very potent wine. The Cyclops drinks it and gets pretty drunk and says, I never got your name. Tell me your name. And of course, again, Odysseus, just like us, you know, automatically lies about who he is and what his name is and the truth about himself. So he says, my name is Nobody. That is my name. So the Cyclops says, excellent, Mr. Nobody. I'm glad you told me your name, because now I will, as you asked me before, give you a guest gift. And here's what it is. I will eat you last. Ha ha ha. He thinks this is the biggest joke. He falls down laughing. He's completely drunk and he passes out. Now, Odysseus and his men put the plan into action. They take the stake that has been cured in the fire. They bring it to white-hot shape. And they plunge it into the Cyclops' eye, blinding him. And, of course, he bellows out. He leaps up, bellows out in pain, and starts freaking out and jumping up and down and yelling for help in a billowing voice. Help, help, help. And all the Cyclops come from all the other caves. They hear this billowing voice, and they come around. And they yell outside the door of the cave, what's going on? Is someone in there doing something to you? We'll help you. And the Cyclops says, nobody is destroying me by trickery and with pain. Nobody is doing this to me. So the other Cyclops say, well, if nobody's doing this to you, then the only alternative is it must be that the gods have it in for you, so there's nothing we can do, and they all go back to their caves and leave them alone. This sounds like I made it up, right? This is the type of thing that I would make up. But actually, you can check it out. You know, read the Odyssey, and you'll find this. So, now the Cyclops is blind. The next morning, he has to let the herds out. The herds have to graze. But he stands, so he moves the rock. That's the point. He had to move the rock. The herds go out, and he can't see anything, but he can feel. He blocks the doorway, and he can feel the backs of all the sheep and goats as they pass out to make sure that the Greeks are not escaping. What he doesn't know is that they're clutching the bottoms of the sheep. And so they escape underneath the sheep. So, the moral of the story is, if you want to escape the confining bounds of egotism, if you want to open yourself to creativity, the best strategy is to be nobody. So what do we mean by being nobody, and what's the practice of it? Because I think this is true. You know, this is my own experience in writing poetry. In order to write poetry, I have to be willing to return to nobody and trust nobody. Because on my own, I tried this for about maybe 5 or 10 years. I tried to write on my own, and it was a miserable failure. I couldn't do it. But when I realized that nobody could write, it got a lot easier and more fun and much more successful. So what do we mean by being nobody? And this is the exploration for this morning. What do we mean by being nobody? And what's the practice of being nobody? And how do we return to being nobody? I tell a couple of stories in here that I won't read them, but I'll just briefly tell you them. One story involved a friend who, and these are, you know, real stories. I mean, I doctored them up a little bit so as not to violate people's privacy, but these are more or less real stories. That one person was a lawyer who really wanted to change the world and went to Washington and, you know, was a real go-getter and he, with good motivation, and he was very effective in, you know, working in policy in Washington, D.C. as a lawyer, but didn't realize that he was sacrificing the nobody side of his life. And little by little, his spirit was sinking. And he got sick and couldn't continue to work. And he came home to California and tried to figure out what to do. And he realized he had two ways of looking at this. One way was he got sick through overwork. He could take a rest, get some medications, some therapy, go back to it. Another way to look at it was maybe he had to integrate the nobody part of his life into who he was and change his sense of his life and who he was and go forth differently than he did before, rather than thinking of it as an aberration or a problem, to think of it as a message that something needed to change. And maybe this is a familiar story to some of us. And he did that, and now he still practices law, but not anymore in Washington, and with a different sense of his life. Then there's another story I tell of a friend who, all of a sudden, in the middle of a business meeting, disappeared. He had the feeling that he wasn't there anymore. And it terrified him. It was at first quite pleasant for about 30 seconds. And then he remembered himself again and he noticed that he had disappeared and it really freaked him out. So are we willing to be nobody? Do we understand what it means to be nobody? Can we integrate being nobody into our lives in such a way? And this is, I think, what Suzuki Roshi means by the primary form of creativity. Do you see the connection? The primary form of creativity is to be willing to return to the nobodiness at the basis of our lives, the silence at the basis of our lives, the sort of non-doing at the basis of our lives, to have a way of returning to that without fear, without resistance, and with confidence. So, this reminds me of a poem, and I'll end with this poem, and then we'll do some writing. I'm nobody, who are you? We all know this poem, right? I'm nobody, who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell one's name, the livelong June, to an admiring bog. So, you see, the problem is that we have to be somebody, but if we're relentlessly somebody, and we have no access to the nobody side of our lives, it's unsustainable and it ends up not being creative. The creativity, as we've all said, you know, in different ways, the creativity comes from the nobody side of who we are. And then we have to know how to hook up the somebody to the nobody, because it's the somebody who will channel the creativity of the nobody into the world through productions of a beautiful party or a day at the beach or a poem or a song. But if it's the somebody who's doing it, it's not going to work. It's not going to give us what we need through our, from our creativity. In the end, our productions are not really going to be beneficial. So what I'd like to do now is take just a few minutes to do a little guided meditation that will lead us to some writing. So let's just return to our feeling of the body, to the breath for a moment. And bring your attention to the breath as it goes in and out. See if you can be with the whole breath coming in and the whole breath going out. Feel sensations in the body. Notice sounds inside and outside the room. And begin to notice thoughts, feelings that arise. And just notice them, and if possible, let go and clear the space for the next thing that arises. Sounds. Sensations of the body. Thoughts. Feelings. Memories. Inner visions. And see if you can find, apart from all these things, somebody there. Is there a somebody that arises? Is there anybody there, apart from these phenomena arising and passing away? What does it feel like to be nobody? So now, let's do a little writing. And I'm going to give you a little bit of instructions here. This is writing for you, for yourself. I'm not going to ask anybody who doesn't want to read it. The idea is not to write something beautiful or spectacular or wonderful, but just to write something spontaneous, to surprise yourself. Not to write the things you know about, but to try to discover things you don't know about through your writing. And the subject to write about, and you take this in any way that you want to take it, is what's it like to be nobody? What does it mean to you to be nobody? And you can actually start, if you want, by, you know, using Emily Dickinson's line, "I'm nobody, who are you?" And start from there. Or any other way you want to start. And we'll use the technique of sort of automatic writing. When I say go, put your pen to the paper and start writing. And let your hand and the process of writing create the next words, rather than, in other words, I think something and then write it down, think something and then write it down. Let the writing itself generate the thoughts, rather than the other way around. Let it be creative, in the sense we were talking about earlier. Let it come from nobody. Let it not... You can even imagine that this is not you writing. It's nobody writing. It's not you. You might say things that you don't believe, or you don't think are true or right, or something like that. So when your pen hits the paper, you begin writing, and you just keep going. Even if you can't think of anything to say, you write, "I can't think of anything to say. Say, 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 say. Can't think of anything, can't think of anything. Say, say, say." And you just keep writing words until that writing generates something. You don't want to stop and think, is the idea. You just keep going. So that's the way it works, okay? And we'll do this for, I think, around 10 or 12 minutes. And like I said, just keep on writing. And if you know, snatches of things that we've said or that we've discussed this morning come into it, that's fine. You know, it could be that you remember and you write those things down, or it could be something, who knows what will happen. You know, something from your distant past, you know, all of a sudden surfaces to your great surprise, or something from somebody else's distant past that you never met surfaces in the writing. That happens sometimes. You get the idea, right? Okay, so if those who have paper or pens to offer would bring them up, and those who need paper and pens could come up here and get them, the rest of us can begin right now, putting pen to paper, and I'll time it for about 10 to 12 minutes. So go, and don't lift your pen from the paper.